I am joined by three giants in the theatrical circles here. Of course, I'm joined by Michael Toomey, Finn Bahanan, and indeed Brian Hogan as well. Lads, you're very, very welcome to the programme. And thanks for coming in.
Thanks a lot. Feeling like giants at all.
Yeah, well, I tell you, you know, when it comes to Thespians, isn't it? Thespians, is that the word? When it comes to Thespians there, again, you are giants when it comes to them. The reason you're here is Gravediggers.
Yes.
Who wants to start off telling us all about Gravediggers? Because this is a programme that's going out here on Community Radio on Monday, isn't it? At 9 p.m, yeah, I think,
12th,
is it?
12th of December.
12th of December, yes, on Monday, the 12th of December. That's right, 12th of December. Next Monday week, yeah. At 9 p.m. Right, Michael, tell us all about it. Tell us about Gravediggers.
Gravediggers is about a cynical old... Sorry, Finbar.
Finbar, do you hear that?
Typecasting.
It's an old gravedigger, bit cynical.
Yes.
And a younger, young gravedigger.
Young fella.
A young fella who's full of enthusiasm. And I suppose the play is set during a plague. Way back in the day.
Yeah.
So it's a kind of an analogy for the pandemic, really. It was written during the pandemic. I wrote it during the pandemic.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, the themes are very similar to the idea of, you know, what do you do and all that social distancing. And
yes.
The young digger is full of enthusiasm. He wants to fix something, but there's a backstory as to why he's so determined to take this job. And they're the only two grave diggers left. The older grave digger is immune, so he's able to work away for a long time. And there's a backstory to him as well.
Right.
So what happens is that there's a revelation between both. Obviously, we won't give the story away, but
yes,
we find out they both kind of pick at each other until we find out what's going on. And then there's a significant incident, which we won't reveal here.
Which turns into,
I suppose, a sort of a realization about where we're at with these difficulties, you know?
Yes.
Yeah.
And so, as you say, it's very, very significant, I suppose, given the pandemic and the whole lot.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. It just kind of mirrors the kind of challenges that we were faced with, I suppose, but it's not serious. It's a dark comedy, but it's a dark comedy, I suppose. Mm. So the banter is a bit gallows, gallows humour.
Yeah, what about it? Mike, I tell you, I want to congratulate you, number one, on the wonderful video you did. A very, very thought-provoking video that you did in St. Mary's.
That was
absolutely tremendous.
And indeed,
that was BBC quality. Absolutely brilliant. And there were so many people said it to me, actually.
Yeah.
That they were blown away with the video.
That's very good.
So, as I said, I am treading on dangerous ground. I am like John the Baptist when it comes to theatrical giants.
Brian has played Jesus before. So.
That's exactly what I was coming to. Step up to the plate there, Brian, and talk to me. Brian, of course, you're no stranger to the boards.
No, not really. Well, I have been for the last number of years, but not recently, no.
Yeah, and of course, recent productions?
There have been very little, really, with the pandemic.
Yes. Before the pandemic, isn't it?
Yeah, it would be, yeah.
But of course, as I said, you were no stranger to your little theatre.
No, thanks very much to the man on my left-hand side here, Phil.
Yes.
Got me introduced a long time ago.
Yes.
Seems like a long time ago.
Yes.
And I suppose this play was very enjoyable to do. And it's very significant because of what happened with the pandemic over the last number of years.
Yes.
It's set in the 1600s, isn't it?
It's set in the 1600s, but I mean, things don't change.
Oh, they don't.
The similarities
were
very...
themes, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
You
yeah.
ought to know
people's concepts and
1663 that you put down in your script. Is that what you remember
was?
That?
That was the first draft. There's a couple of drafts.
Well, obviously, yeah. Finbar, of course, again, as I said, Finbar, you're very welcome to the programme. And again, you epitomise, I think, to an awful lot of people in this town, your little theatre and training the boards.
Yeah.
Because you're at it a hell of a long time. You're a long time at this now, you know.
So I remember coming down Water Lane and saying, I hope to God everything goes well tonight. And then that changed before immediately I got in and said, I'm going to make a make a splash here now, like if I can, to myself. But when I was, just before I went on, then I had the usual shakes and all the rest of it. But Albert Cole was very reassuring.
Yeah,
he was a mighty man.
Of course, look, just going back, while we have a chance, like past productions of your little theatre, my goodness, like you really excelled yourselves when you come to, like John B. Keane's The Field.
I remember
he did that, and
Albert played the bishop, didn't he? I was a priest in that, didn't he? In that production,
he did, yeah.
He did, and actually, I remember being at that, and he played it so cleverly that he was supposed to come on. He just played the bishop or the priest or something like that. But during halftime, of course, naturally the lights went up and there was ticket sales and the whole lot, and the hall was packed. And about maybe 5 or 10 minutes into halftime, the lights and the curtain was closed and the lights stayed on. And Albert slowly walked in the main door, the side door.
From the back, is it?
No, from the side. Okay. The side. Yeah. He walked in from the side and he walked down the back.
Yeah.
And he was dressed in the full regalia of the bishops and the mitre and the whole lot. And he slowly walked up the steps up in front of the curtain, and here he was. Name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost. And the whole audience blessed themselves.
It was absolutely
it was a brilliant piece of theatre.
A man never wore a cape so well.
Yeah. But again, it was past productions, film about where we have a chance there, like in A Streetcar Named Desire, I think, was another one.
Oh, yeah, I remember, as well.
Yeah, there were so many of them that she'd done down through the years.
Oh, yeah, they were fine plays, like, but there's a lot of substance in this play too.
Well, the radio play is much different, isn't it?
That's what I was going to say. What's different about writing a play for radio than writing with say a script for with say TV or a script for
well,
a production?
It's interesting because Brian said it was a physical play, you know, and that like they're digging away all the time, but like on the radio, it's all dialogue, obviously. It depends on it, you know. The action is hard to get across. You know, if there's physical action, that's a challenge in radio, all right.
But of course, nowadays, I suppose that you've so much access to different sounds, of course.
Oh, it's incredible. Like, I mean, the BBC Sound Archive was digitized there only...
That's right, yeah.
So last year, you'd know better than me, maybe 2 years ago.
Yeah, and it was absolutely brilliant.
And it's fantastic. The quality is stunning.
Yeah.
And then you have, like... freesound.org, and they're all free, you know, sound effects. So, and of course, the editing software that people have at home as well, it just opens up a whole area for people to work in. But I kind of wrote this with the two lads in mind as well, before I even asked them to take part, actually, because I had worked with them before with The Last Days of Dominic Collins.
Oh, yes.
And Finbar played George Carew. And Brian played Dominic Collins himself, and I thought
Tommy Curtin was
Tommy
Curtin played the father, and Anne Brooks played Dominic's mother.
That's right.
I think John Kennedy had a part in it, didn't he?
No, he wasn't.
Was that Dominic Collins?
Maybe that might have been
the production that was held.
I think there was actually a play, wasn't there? Someone did a play up in the church.
That's
many
the one.
Years
yeah.
Kenneth Thorne was involved in that.
That's right.
But I kind of thought of the two lads, and I thought they'd be perfect for the parts, and it turned out that they were, really.
So you wrote the play, basically, and that's the kind of, you know, instead of writing the play, you actually had the two lads in mind, and you wrote the play around.
I never work without the end game in mind. I never write or do anything, really, without actual... the idea of the product at the end.
Yes.
So I have to have all the ducks lined up.
Of course,
it mightn't work out that way, but I always think in the end, what's it going to look like? What's it going to sound like? And what standard is it going to be as well? So if I can't reach a standard, I will abandon it, you know? Mm. No, that doesn't mean it's...
So you're setting the goal very, very high for yourself, the bar very high for yourself, isn't
you? Yeah, but I mean, like, you might not reach it always, but I mean, like, why would you do anything unless you can do it to the best of your own ability anyway, at least, you know what I mean? I'm not saying it's a certain standard, but like your own standards, you know what I mean? Whatever you think you can achieve. So I was delighted to get the lads because I just really like working with them as well. And I, do you know, above anything else, it was great fun.
Of course.
Yeah, certainly. Funny story about the play, and we won't repeat exactly what was said, but...
I don't mind. I'm all ears.
There was a part in the play where the old cynic, the gravedigger, as we call him, as he's named in the play, he's the great, Finbar's the gravedigger, and Brian is the young fella.
Young fella.
And Finbar got lost in character, as all great actors should do.
Yes.
I think he had to turn around and say something like, put a bucket over your head if you like, I don't care. Yeah, and the F-bomb was dropped in the middle during rehearsals.
As one does, like. You know, and people say they get away with it. Look, that's part of the script. Yeah. That's for effect, like, effect.
I think Robert De Niro refers to that as method acting.
Method.
It was the lesser of the two F-bombs, wasn't it?
The lesser of the two was left in. The Irish version was left in, yeah. But the Robert De Niro version was edited out.
You know, I've often wondered, actually, but like, when you write a play for radio, now, forgive me for saying this now, but if I write a play for radio, obviously it's so much easier because actually you can go back and edit it and you can put in sound effects and all that. But when you go on stage there, and I'd often wonder there, like, is there any deviation? Like, I know, I suppose Finbar now would be the master of this, like, that, you know, you have a set play, set lines, and you're supposed to stick to them so religiously. But how do you do it? How can you remember word for word all those lines for maybe an hour and a half?
Oh, it takes a good few weeks or even months in some cases, like, to get to know your part, doesn't it?
No, it does indeed, yeah.
And if it's a good play, then everything hangs together. So there's an expectation, really, of the way your character is going to be. Like, and how he'll deliver the next sentence, even, you know.
Yes.
There's
that can change from night to night, too.
The
pronunciation or the intent might change a small bit on the spur of the moment. Maybe even the actor themselves don't know they're going to do it until it happens. But that's part of the game and it's part of the excitement of it. And you're playing off each other.
If you don't hit all the words, like, exactly as they are or anything like that,
it can throw the response.
That's the only problem. But the content would be the same. Like, as Brian says, it's finalized by the characters, by the actors. You know, it's a creative process, like, even on the night.
It's constantly changing.
Yeah, constantly.
I would say, if you don't mind me coming in, I would say that happened even with us, didn't it? And, like... You know, there was a script there, obviously, that was written. But then the lads were saying, oh, we'll drop this line or we'll drop that word.
Yes.
And in a collaborative process, you should never be precious about things like that, because if the meaning is carried, that's the end goal.
Yeah.
So everybody understands how the characters feel and why they're reacting the way they are. And there was moments when, you know, when Brian said to me, look, there's one line that was shortened, and I was like, fine. Do you know what I mean? Because it improved it. So if you're not precious about it, if you're not precious about things in a collaborative thing, and everybody knows what they're trying to achieve, and the characters come across, it's the meaning, really. You can change words, and I know words are very important and all that, but if you change them, but the meaning, the audience understands the meaning and the motives and all that.
So if there is room for a little deviation.
Absolutely.
There is room for a little deviation, provided the meaning goes across.
Yeah, and Finbar said it as well, while we were rehearsing, you know, and we probably didn't have long enough to rehearse, actually. I rushed the lads a little bit because it was a deadline. But there were times when, you know, both lads were grappling with, like, who are we?
And I think it's very, very important, and I think, Finbar, I've seen you time and time again on this, like, when you actually go on stage, you actually morph into the personality of the person that you're portraying.
I think that's essential.
I think I've seen you in The Year of the Hiker. I've seen you, and you played the part to actually perfection. Actually, that was a radio play that you'd done as well. You'd done it for the radio as well, you know, at one stage there, back in the pirate days, so to speak. But you actually can morph into the, and I suppose we've seen that with the likes of yourself, we've seen it with the likes, I suppose, of Mary Flavin Colbert out there in Inch, the same thing.
Yeah,
you know, you can morph yourself into the character. You become the character, don't you?
Yeah, Brian too, you know, does that. He identifies
yes.
very much with it, so that you...
You actually like become the character, don't you?
It's part of the process,
acting,
isn't
acting
it?
Acting with him then you sort of helps you to get into the your own character and all
yes.
that,
yeah.
and to create this other reality that
yeah.
Happens on the stage. And I think that's essential, because the audience are collaborating as well as... Mm.
Yes.
You know, they're in on it. Like,
oh,
they're part of...
Yeah,
their response then kind of dictates how...
Dictates how
the interpretation goes, like, to some extent.
So basically, like, you're relying on the audience a lot to carry your song, that you're not oblivious to the audience on stage.
It's all teamwork, really, yes. even including the back row of the theatre, like, and...
Of course, yeah.
The people who occupy those seats. So you got to reach him then, so gestures have to be bigger than they would close up.
I get you, yeah.
For example, in on the television, for example, or cinema, the camera is close. We can do all kinds of queer things.
Yeah.
And then it's right with it. And the lifting of an eyebrow counts.
Yes.
But when you're trying to reach the, we'll say...
The back row of the theatre.
Gestures have to grow. And your voice, of course, has to get back there.
You have to amplify everything, basically. Movement, sounds, projection. Voice projection, etc.
That's why I think all early cinema, early silent cinema, they're theatre actors.
Mm.
And even though they're being filmed, they're throwing their arms around and they're tossing themselves.
That was all the crack that time, And when there was no sound, that's what they had.
If you look at the antics of Charlie Chaplin,
that's what I mean. They're all theatre actors.
Yeah.
They're throwing themselves around. It looks ridiculous.
Have to compensate for no sound but movements.
When sound first came in, a lot of actors lost their jobs because of their voices.
There was a famous cowboy, actually. He had a very kind of female voice.
Yes.
In the silent movies, I think he did Hell's Gate, I think it's a fantastic western, but the minute he spoke, he was sacked. He didn't have that John Wayne. He had the John Wayne look, but he didn't have the John Wayne voice.
But I suppose a lot of them too were dubbed in this year, I suppose. A lot of the famous actors, like singers, the same. Nelson Eddy, I think, was the same thing. Voice was dubbed up, whatever the case may be.
To dub the labs.
I don't think you would have anything. I don't think you would have any problem in sense. No. But just to get back to the play, I know I'm watching the clock and all this of it there, but just to get back to the play itself, The Gravediggers. This is not your first production, Mike, for radio.
No, I did The Last Days of Dominic Collins, which was a three-part, and it was kind of big, really.
Yes.
There was big themes, and that wasn't it for her. It was heavy going.
That was heavy going.
A lot of work on that.
Maybe too heavy, what?
A lot of work on that.
The historical end of it had to be adhered to too, I suppose, as well. You were kind of conscious of that.
Yeah, and it was The Last Days. In other words, it was his time in prison before, so a lot of it was like... There were a lot of poetic license as to what was his mindset.
Yes.
And he was visited by his mother and then by his father. Mm. There was three parts. His mother trying to convince him to come out, then his father, and there was a real personality clash there. And then there was the visit by his torturer, George Crew, these are all real figures, obviously.
Yeah. Mm.
And George Crew did torture Dominic Collins, but also teased him with... opportunities to
set out.
become actually high up in the Church of Ireland,
yes.
The Protestant side of religion at that time, and incentives, torture, typical as what you would do today, starve and feed,
exactly,
and feed,
and
of course he doesn't. So it was heavy going
very
work
intense
with the lads.
Enjoyable, super job.
Yeah,
and this was completely different.
I suppose this gave you a lot of, I suppose.
Yeah, I just wanted to get away from that. I've done a lot of historical stuff, and sometimes I get tired of it.
Yeah,
sometimes
yeah.
I just like to break away to something a little bit little less.
And this is
serious.
Something that it's lighthearted in a sense, but it does carry a message.
Yeah, and I can't get away from it. Noel, I'm just a dark person. No matter what I do, there's always a dark twist.
Yeah, good. That makes it. That's what we're all looking forward to, the twist in the end.
That might be our stage playing it. We were flirting with the idea of doing a stage play.
I'd love to see this as a stage production because it's very minimalist, you know.
The two actors,
the setting is just like graveyard. Actually, can I just say why this was written originally? And I want to mention somebody else as well. Originally, for the Collegiate Church 800 anniversary, there was a competition set up through CRI.
There was, that's right,
for the John Kennedy Memorial Play.
That's
right. Remember?
Yeah, I remember that, yeah.
In John's memory, of course, because John had a great connection to the arts. And I was kind of motivated to write it then for that. And it was, of course, the pandemic hit and then everything fell in line.
Yes.
But a very good friend of mine, Brian Mulcahy, lived in Hong Kong, for the last number of decades, he actually won that award.
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And I can't remember the name of the play now, but it was set. It had to be set in a church. That was
one of the criteria.
That was the criteria.
So
I thought, where would you set it in the church? And I actually had an idea of a physical play taking place in the churchyard itself.
Yes,
you know, two gravediggers.
Yes,
and I thought, oh, that's lovely. That's you could actually hold it. And I think the idea was to hold it in the grounds or the church.
Well, it was very in keeping, I suppose, with it, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think your little theatre were brought on board and they were going to act on it. But unfortunately, with the pandemic, things fell apart. But I'd just like to mention Brian, the fact that Brian actually won that.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
He beat me to the post, which is very hard to take.
But you accepted it magnanimously.
I got your revenge by holding a radio play.
Yes.
So Brian got the fame and the rewards, and forever in eternity will be marked as the one and only John. But I hope it's not the one and only John Memorial.
Fear not, Michael.
He got the gold medal.
Fear not, Michael. Your day will come.
My day will come.
I think it has.
But I just wanted to mention Brian.
Of course,
and the fact that he did write a fantastic play, and hopefully someday he might be able to do a radio version of it, you know, because it was the winning play and it'll be lovely to hear at some stage.
And
that was the motivation originally, yeah.
There's something about a radio play that holds people's attention.
Oh, I love them, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, if you look at it with other stations, like, I do think, is it BBC Radio 4 put on a play every day? Yeah. And it's absolutely, of course, they have the facilities there, but it's the listenership that they have for that goes through the roof, actually.
I wouldn't knock the facilities here. I can tell you the...
Well, the lads in Fairless, the lads are very good. Lads, where are we going to... Big question now before we leave it. Where are you going to go from here? Is there going to be a sequel? Is there going to be a part two? Is there going to be another...
We couldn't say that because it would spoil the ending.
But you will be, like, once you've started, once you got bitten by the bug, like, there'll be no stopping, I'd say.
Well, I'd love to work with the lads.
That will continue on.
Good.
Yeah, of course.
We're delighted to hear it.
Start writing.
The play is called Gravediggers and it'll be broadcast here on Community Radio 104 FM on Monday, December the 12th at 9 p.m. And for those of you who cannot receive it or whatever the case may be, it'll be podcasted in our system as well. As every other play has done as well. So, lads, as I said, I'd like to thank the three of you very much for coming in
and chatting
to us.
Thanks very much, Noel.
It's great.
Can I say thanks to CRY as well, to Yvonne, who asked me, had I something as well? So, and to yourselves, and to the studio, to Tom O'Keefe especially, who did
brilliant.
An absolute gentleman as well. And to have the facilities in town, and I think we just chatted a little bit about beforehand, and I won't drag it out, but it is incredible for anybody who is an artist, whether you're acting like the lads are or you're writing like I am, to be able to put on a radio play. And
that's what we're here for. Yeah, it's rare. Lads, again, Michael Toomey, Finn Bahannon and Brian Hogan, listen, thanks very much for coming in. As I said, do they say in theatrical circles break a leg or break a hand or something like that, but don't break anything in
we're
the
right age, no, we don't want to hear that.
Because we need all that.
That saying came from
lads, again, as I said, thanks very much for coming in and chatting to us. There you have it, lads. It's broadcast here on Community Radio. I'll just reiterate again, it's broadcast. It's called Grave Diggers, and it's going out on Monday, the 12th of December, here at 9 p.m. Don't miss it. And indeed, if you're unfortunate to miss it, it will, of course, be podcasted on our system as well.